Blog Talk Radio.
Found it. This is the Sonic Companion. I'm your host for this episode, Dale Graham. Welcome back. And for all of you who are new to the show, I hope that you find it enriching, educational, and entertaining. It's the 187th day of the year, 6th of July, 2014. Here in Canada, on the 1st of July, we celebrated the birth of our nation and the Declaration, as we know it today. The Americans, just south of us, you know, that clamorous bunch that are always running around trying to define goodness for all the rest of the world, they've celebrated the 4th of July. It's just 99 days till Thanksgiving, 172 days until Christmas. So here we are already in the 28th week of the year. Balance, you hold the calendar in our hand, we're tipping, we're at 51.23% of the year. It's done. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. I call this our Tour de France show. It's an annual multi-stage bicycle, primarily held in France and occasionally in other countries. It began in 1903, if you believe that. And it was done primarily to increase sales of the magazine Lotto. Interesting little piece of history, though. It started out of a bit of conflict. And continued on from there. The plan was just a five-stage race from the 31st of May until the 5th of July, starting in Paris and then stopping in Lyon and Marseille and Bordeaux and Nantes, I think, and then going back to Paris. And then Toulouse was added later because it was long, you know, going across southern France from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic was just huge. But the stages would go through the night and finish the next afternoon with rest days before they set off again. But the idea came from a junior partner in a discussion. The earliest effort was about a disagreement. About the guilt and culpability of a fellow. The magazine Lotto wasn't doing very well. The people that were putting money up for it wanted a bit more, so so sales were lower than the rival it was intended to surpass. So the last to speak, and they're sort of coming up with ideas. The incident in L'Hotel was the start, you know, really quite keen. And here's how that went. The roots to or something, roots go back to something called the Dreyfus Affair. And that divided France around the end of the 19th century. And it was about the innocence of Alfred Dreyfus. Dreyfus was a soldier convicted for selling military secrets to the Germans. He was later exonerated, but opinions became quite heated, and there were, you know, street demonstrations on both sides. What would you expect? We wouldn't expect any less from the Fourth Republic. One was what the historian Eugene Weber called an absurd political shindig at the Auteuil horse race course in Paris in 1899. And among those who were involved was the Comte Jules Albert de Dion. And he was the owner of the Dion Bouton Car Works. And he believed that Dreyfus was guilty. De Dion was jailed 15 days and fined 100 francs for his role at Auteuil, which he struck Emile Laubert in the head with his walking stick. Poor Emile was the president of France. So the incident was tailor-made for the sporting press, of course. And the first and largest press of the day was Le Villo. And that sold, you believe this or not, 80,000 copies a day. So its editor, Pierre Giffard, thought that Dreyfus was innocent. And he reported the arrest in a way that did not make de Dion happy. So, and he became so angry that he joined other anti-Dreyfusards, such as the Adolphe Clément and Edouard Michelin. Yeah, Michelin tires. And opened the Daily Rival sports page, Lotto. Yeah, important key here. The new newspaper appointed Henri de Grange as the editor. And he was a prominent cyclist and an owner with Victor Godet of the Velodrome. And de Dion knew him through his cycling reputation, through books and cycling articles that he'd written. And Lotto was not the success its backers wanted, of course. Sales were not doing well. And they had a meeting on the 20th of November 1902 in the middle floor of Lotto's offices in Paris. The last to speak was the most junior, the chief cycling journalist, Joe Lefebvre. He was only 26 at the time. De Grange had taken him from Gifford's paper, probably a bit bright, eh? Lefebvre suggested a six-day race. It was very popular at the time for these long races, bicycle races, to be sponsored by newspapers, and so they could sell more. But nothing like this had been discussed before. And as he listened to it, De Grange, the newspaper editor, thought this will nail, as he said, nail Giffard's beak shut. So this went on, and they announced the race on the 19th of January, 1903. So very quickly, they thought, this is right. We have to do this. So... So instead, they cut what they did. They went through the development of the race, and only 15 competitors had entered. Today, they have somewhere between 20 and 29 teams, 20 to 22 teams, and they have about 9 riders each. So things have grown since that day. And he cut the length to 19 days, and he changed the dates. From the 1st to the 19th of July, offered them a daily allowance to those who averaged, if he went at least 20 kilometers on all of the stages, the equivalent to what a rider would have expected to earn each day he worked in a factory. And he cut the entry fee from 20 to 10 francs, and he set the first prize at 12,000 francs. And the prize for each day's winner at 3,000 francs. The winner would thereby win 6 times what most workers earned in a year. That attracted between 60 and 80 entrants. And the higher number may have included serious inquiries and some who dropped out, but among them were not just professionals, but amateurs, some unemployed, some quite adventurous. You know, let's go and give it a shot. So De Grange seems not to have forgotten the Dreyfus affair that launched this. He announced the new race on the 1st of July, 1903, by citing the writer Emile Zola, fairly, whose open letter in which every paragraph started J'accuse, led to Dreyfus's acquittal, established the florid style he used The first Tour de France started almost outside the Café Réveil Matin in the junction of the Moulin and Corbel roads in the village of Montgaron. It was waved away by the starter George Ambran at 3:16 in the afternoon on the 1st of July. Just passed that anniversary, didn't we? Maybe that's why Canada was born on that day. Good thing to do. So that's a little bit of the history of the first tour. And the first arrival, you want to know, of course, who won? A fellow named Guerin, Maurice Guerin. And he finished ahead of the last rider, Milichon, who was 64 hours, 47 minutes, and 22 seconds behind. So there you have it. He won the first and last two stages, did Guerin. That's the Tour de France. We also are in the middle of something that is known to be the world's largest sporting event, the World Cup. Football at its very, very best. So this was held in 1930, the very first one, and they held it in Uruguay. Yeah, as in the scandal that's just caused one of the greatest football players of our time to be censored again for his antics on the field. The first one only had 13 teams by invitation. And the first official international football match was played in 1872 in Glasgow. That was between Scotland and England. And that was very rare. You know, the sport was very rarely played outside Great Britain at the time. In 1900, the sport had gained ground all over the world. And the first official international match outside of the British Isles played between Uruguay and Argentina in Montevideo in July 1902. FIFA, the governing body, was founded in Paris in the 22nd of May 1904, and that was the associations of France and Belgium, Denmark, the Netherlands, Spain, Sweden and Switzerland, and Germany pledged to join. And as it gained popularity, here's the rub. It was contested as an IOC, an Olympic, recognized Olympic sport in 1900 and 1904 Summer Olympics, and the 1906 Intercalculated Games before becoming an official FIFA-supervised Olympic competition at the 1908 Summer Olympics. And this was organized by England's Football Association, and the event was for amateur players only and was regarded suspiciously as a show rather than a competition. The England National Amateur Football Club won the event in 1908 and 1912. And there was an attempt made by FIFA to organize an international football tournament between nations outside of the Olympics. And that first one took place in Switzerland. And those are the very earliest days of international football. With the Olympic event continuing to be contested only between amateur teams, competitions involving professional teams also started to appear. The Torino Internazionale Stampa Sportiva was held in Turin, Italy in 1908, one of the first. And the following year, Sir Thomas Lipton organized the Sir Thomas Lipton Trophy, and he also held that in Turin. But in 1914, FIFA agreed to recognize the Olympic tournament as a world football championship for amateurs, and took the responsibility for organizing things. And that led to the very first international competition at the 1920 Summer Olympics. It happened to be won by Belgium. And then Uruguay won the tournaments in 1924 and 28. So now we have what is today. It was been continued annually ever since that time, with cancellations for the First and Second World War. Of course it would. Everything came to a stop during that carnage. Hope lessons learned, huh? So today, if you look over your shoulder, on Tuesday you're coming down to the finals. And the very last match, Tuesday, the final, and then the next on the Wednesday, and the grand event, the last match to crown the best team in the world will be held on the 13th of July. So if you're looking to participate in the biggest sporting event of the world, not even close to it, nothing else is even close to it, check it out. Check it out. This year the host is Brazil. And so you decide. You know, the last winner was Spain. They were put out. Before that, the last winner was Italy, you know. Go Canada, eh? There's a little bit of what's going on right now around us. And if all of you, I know everybody in the world becomes an Elvis fan at this time of the year. The Elvis Festival is coming up over in Collingwood. Here's a little taste. The first rock.
Born through a party in the county jail. The prison band was there and they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard the knocked out jailbird sing that rock. Everybody that rock. Everybody in on the jailbox was dancing to a jail out of rock. Spider Murphy played his inner saxophone.
Kind of interesting. Yeah. What's that have to do with things Masonic? I'll tell you. It's interesting. That's the kind of music that a lot of the older boys in lodges had in their background. Either they were very young boys at the time, you know, the baby boomers who was playing in the background, or the fellows that are in their in the late 60s and 70s and 80s, they'd all remember that playing on the car radio when they were going to pick up their groceries. It's really amazing for me, I guess. It is amazing when I see how self-conscious Masons are with each other. If you play this type of music in a group of Freemasons, It's odd that people wouldn't be tapping their foot to the beat or smiling because of just pure nostalgia. The innocence of rock and roll way back. Remember, this was a fellow that was scandalous at the time. Remember, Ed Sullivan wouldn't show him on television below the waist down because of the provocative effect that might have on the audience. Kind of strange when you look back on it now. That how could we be so uncomfortable and self-conscious about a common part of world history? It's not a matter of whether you like the music or not. It was there, and so were you, and so were the memories. And compared to today, what does it teach us? It wasn't so bad. I think things like rock and roll music are what is going to break down barriers between cultures and one day bring about the kind of unification that Freemasonry thinks about. We have some wonderful ideas. Some of them are achievable. Most of them are very, very hard to put into place. But they're always worth going for, aren't they? Why the self-consciousness? I need your advice, gentlemen. This is we're going to inject to try and inject a moment of Masonic angst and to everything that's going on. Quoting to you from John Adams. John Adams, yeah, the congressman, that one. He explains to the world there are two types of education. One should teach us how to make a living, and the other how to live. Couldn't have said it better ourselves, John. Well put. The other, how to live. Freemasonry fits into that part of our brain, that part of our being. The day of celebrity doesn't really get us ahead. But where are we? Where was it ever explained that that's the notion, to get ahead, that the nature of man, is to compete with one another? Where is it ever written that we're not to look out for each other and to think about the greater good all the time? This experiment that we've been part of, this marketplace experiment, has crashed and burned around us. We're still paying. The ruins are still smoldering, and we're still paying for it. The notion that based on, what is it, hubris or greed, that doesn't work. Even when it brings back notions of, what was his name, Tom Malthus, the Malthusian notion that there's not enough food, that eventually the world will become so populated that there won't be enough food to support it. Well, that took a lot of traction. That gained a lot of traction. Masons, we should know better than to believe everything that's written. We've been subjected to some pretty nasty yellow journalism. Well, this Malthus was an idea that has been proven so many times to be wrong. Oh, we have problems feeding everybody now, but that's not because of population. Truth is, we can't figure out our system of distribution. Our political system is just a mess. We know that. No surprise. But it seems somehow, a tastier bit to accept something that's just pure conjecture. Pure conjecture. H.G. Wells believed it. Sadly to say, there are people even to this day that still walk around with that one in their pocket. You look around, the studies, the science has proven that we can be very productive. Our food production and distribution can support larger growing populations. When we know that eventually, like any species, population growth will top off and begin to drop back. Any good conservationist or hunter out there will talk to you about that when he's out harvesting or hunting. So how are you and I any different? We believe what we want to believe. The public believes what they want to believe about us. Let us tenderly and kindly cherish, therefore, the means of knowledge. Let us dare to read, to think, to speak, and write. It's John Adams for you. You will ever remember that all the end of study is to make you a good man and a useful citizen. Let every sluice of knowledge be opened and set aflowing. I read my eyes out and can't read half enough. The more one reads, the more one sees we have to read. This is a man who had a deep sense of conviction. Posterity, you will never know how much it costs the present generation to preserve your freedom. I hope you will make good use of it. If you do not, I shall repent in heaven that I ever took half the pains to preserve it. Make it worthwhile. Democracy, he said, never lasts long. It soon wastes, exhausts, and murders itself. There was never a democracy that did not commit suicide. Ouch. Liberty, according to my metaphysics, is a self-determined power in an intellectual agent. It implies thought and choice and power. Liberty, once lost, is lost forever. Cities may be rebuilt and a people reduced to poverty may acquire fresh property. But a constitution of government, once changed from freedom, can never be restored. Because power corrupts, society's demands for moral authority and character increase as the importance of the position increases. We want our leaders to be the embodiment of our beliefs. Funny that. We always know the autocrat, person that does things because they understand the power that they wield. Doesn't change the way they're measured. Doesn't change a bit because they can't do that. The autocrat is one of the most transparent of all. There's somebody that's taken the ball and run away so they can play with it all by themselves at any cost. The cost of that connection, cost of fraternity, that's the price of the autocrat. What if I talk to you? I need advice here, brethren. As always, are you kidding? I can't function without your advice. A life well spent in Freemasonry. When is a Freemason not a Freemason? Boy, I was really clever when I wrote that, wasn't I? Freemasonry is vulnerable to mockery. But which is worse, the balefulness of cowards or the indifference of a brother who fails to live out his obligations? We owe each entered apprentice the training and guidance he requires to help him achieve his Masonic goals, to reach his Masonic potential. When we put this out to a group of Freemasons, the room files with conjecture, criticism, and defensiveness. Oh my. So I'll not do that. What I offer are some ideas to move the discussion along, if you will allow. It is plausible the dynamic tensions we experience within the lodge are necessary to maintain the orbit of Masonic principles. Yeah, that thoughtless comment balances off the penetrating strategic insights. Mystery of Freemasonry is the oxygen we breathe. The individual mind is a fertile ground that fights the suffocation of compliance. In order to assert the need to calculate those aspects of experience needed to achieve our goals. Some people find a symphony discordant and unfamiliar. Others find the achievement of symphonic music captures them. I cannot add to that conversation without saying, if we do not appreciate an achievement because we have not learned its importance, then the risk is not so much toward the object of achievement as it is to limiting growth. Taste, good manners, culture, refinement, acceptance, flexibility. Where is the bigger man when you need him? I could use some help here, brethren. Ah, when is a Mason not a Mason? When we turn our back on our obligations, yeah. And how do we do that? Uncomfortably. But you know that I'm a inspired lot. Speaking of symphonies, listen to a little bit of Rachmaninoff, please. See if it sets the tone. Thank you. enough. Should have been a Mason. Should really have been a Mason. Yeah. Can I talk to you? I have some other things that I need to know. We can just, it's hard to believe that I could sit in one spot and lose track of material around me that I need. I'm going to talk to you, brethren, about, before I talk to you about the first global drink. You want to know the first global drink? You're going to find out in a minute here. But if, just to carry on the introduction of the storyline of this program, when is a Mason or not is a Mason, I'm going to read you a passage from Observing the Craft. This is written by Andrew Hammer. Some of you may have seen him in Toronto a few years ago, last year, as a matter of fact. And when he was the keynote speaker. And in his book, What is Observance? I think he captured what I was trying to get at, of course, a lot better than I could. It is impossible to be properly observant of anything that you have not taken the time and effort to understand. If you are too busy accumulating memberships and appellations in every so-called Masonic organization you can manage to find, you will not be able to devote the time and effort needed to cultivate Masonic observance within your lodge. What I am calling on you to do is to commit and act on the first principle, to demonstrate with your actions the truth that the symbolic lodge is supreme over all other bodies that are connected to Freemasonry or in any way claim to be Masonic. That requires a tight focus upon the symbolic lodge that deals with its lessons, its operations, and its management only. The reason this is considered necessary is because too many Masons are moved at a ridiculous pace through various bodies and titles without ever fully understanding the experience and lessons of the 3 degrees of Freemasonry. Hear, hear, Andrew. What is worse is that in some places this has been done all but intentionally. The lessons of the symbolic lodge can be studied throughout a lifetime and still yield new insights. Yet the attitude that prevails in many areas is that men should join every appended body that takes their fancy as soon as possible in order to move higher up a ladder that does not in reality exist. The result is that the Masonic symbolic lodge is often left behind in the dust, with precious few lessons being imparted from that institution, which is the very heart and soul of all the other innovations that have been derived from it. Worship of Brother Hammer. Let's sit down and have a talk. I believe those words. I believe those words. And yeah, I participate in a card carrier in a number of them. In a few appendant bodies. But I think, respectfully, I think our brother may be, he's talking about purpose. But let me ask you, listeners, about the motive. Why do Masons follow up with those appended bodies? He's suggesting that it's done intentionally and deliberately. I think, well, if that's the case, that's a bit sad that somebody would do that to you or me, to move us through very quickly so that we don't ask too many questions. We don't contemplate. I think perhaps that element does exist out there, but I tend to think there's also this matter of disillusionment. And I'd like to add maybe my own couple of paragraphs to what Brother Hammer has said. People are coming to us with an expectation that is beyond the control of Freemasonry. It comes from the heart. An expectation when you walk through the doors blindly and make obligations about trusting the people that are around you, without really knowing what it is you're stepping into. Well, we open up a door, and I don't think we answer the calling that comes from opening up that door. We don't answer the calling for a lot of men, apparently. Membership continues to decline. And we can find reasons for that. Reasons that are salve for our own conscience, if you accept it. But I'm afraid, I don't mean to be harsh, but some of those reasons seem to be excuses. I have to accept it that way. They're not reasons. Reasons are facts that are beyond. It's like the sun coming up. Well, it's not the sun coming up. It's the world orbiting, isn't it? It's like the movement of the air. The seasons here in this part of the world. The fact is, there's something not happening, I would say. If we are to feed the intellect and the spiritual makeup, the body of a man through Freemasonry in order to improve character, then we have an obligation to do that. Not to define what that is in its totality, because it's an ever-changing task. And it varies from man to man to man. A practical man may not understand, may not grasp the nuances of metaphysics, but he will understand the benefit of metaphysics. That's all right. My goodness, that's all right. You and I may not understand a particular stream of science, but that's not to say we don't respect it and realize that it does have value. Yeah. So around us, I would suggest there are forces at play that aren't deliberate, but are there if we choose to look at them. The larger question, the disappointment, the disillusionment. We are now 40,000. So, is the bottom dropping out? I don't think so. Freemasonry doesn't have a bottom to it. It has a history. And that history loops back, I think, so many times. String theory? You think that we have an obligation to teach, but we also have an obligation to explain to the student, to the apprentice, that part of the lesson of how to live can be learned through the work, through contact with other people. And part of it comes from the intellectual, the development of your own mind, the expression of my self-discipline. Nobody does that for you. If you choose to ignore that, the results are what you have. And it's not easy because it's not intended to be easy. Taking on a task that is a challenge teaches us something about ourselves, as a man and as a person. Something for nothing, something produced from the efforts of other people. Like I said, where is the bigger man? Is it just a lack of manners? Learn manners. Conviction? Learn conviction. Study? You don't want to study. Or do you just think that this comes about by dressing up? Really? Then in that case, give me a set of golf clubs and I'm Tiger Woods. Come on, we can do better than that. I think this is an area that's always been part of Freemasonry from the very start. That comfort level with accepting that there's a part that's unknown, but that does not mean we shouldn't pursue it. That does not mean we should trivialize. But that we learn and realize that some of these tasks do require a lifetime. Now, the question for the individual is, how are you going to spend your time? How are you going to present yourself to the world around you as a man thoughtful and in pursuit of character development in a very self-conscious way, or as a man doing that authentically? Look at me, look at me. Praise me. I'm somehow superior. Look at me. Aren't I doing it well? Can't I walk more perfectly than you? Yeah, really. That's enough. Give me your advice. You know, what do I know? What do I know? As much as the next fellow. What does Hammer know? Things you observe. The value of these opinions, which opinions do you follow? Something that just agrees with your own thinking, or something that challenges it a little bit? I always think that when I can admit to myself that I don't have all of the answers about Freemasonry, then that means for me, you know, opening up drawers and pulling doors that have not yet been opened in my mind. And then understanding ethically what the goals are, where am I headed, what is the objective of doing that? The objective of developing tolerance is very, very challenging. I don't think one can develop tolerance without experiencing some pain. Who was it that said, was it Homer that said, forgiving an enemy is much easier than forgiving a friend? Those personal letdowns, eh? How do men of character handle that when we see them? Do we think for a moment they haven't faced difficulty? That they're perfect in every way? Of course not. Of course not. Only a fool would present himself that way to the world, because in that audience out there, unbeknownst to the fool, are men that do get it. So, remember the words today? Think about the words of Andrew Hammer. How can we take on and do justice to the obligations, the meanings, unless we take the time to study them? And if we're not sure where to start, we ask. There's help. Or you stumble, bump your head against the wall, come up to the barriers, and keep trying. Much easier to be the beer and hot dogs kind of thing. No, I would disagree. For thoughtful men, that's painful just to, how do the kids say it, dumb it down? It's painful. It's like, it's not like we've lost something. The something is there. There's something that's important. It's not lost. It's just not where we are. And I think when we get to that, when that thought runs through our mind, this is what I thought was going to happen here, and it's not happening. Then we turn to the appendant orders, where there is a different kind of promise of answers and revelations of learning. All about character, eh? The first global drink, but I digress. On a September day in 1647, you okay for 17th century? A little talk. I know some of you still have shirts and jackets from that period. It's hanging in your closet, but an Englishman by the name of Richard Lingen caught his first glimpse of the Caribbean island Barbados from the deck of the ship Achilles. Being now come in sight of this happy island, the nearer we came, the more beautiful it appeared to our eyes. Place had plague. He was just thinking, well, we'll stop, take out some supplies, and we'll keep going. Stay for 3 years. And he was able to take on all kinds of accounts. The first English settlers arrived in Barbados in 1627. The island was uninhabited. And, of course, they set about trying to grow tobacco, claimed to be the worst that grows in the whole world. So then the settlers just brought in sugar cane and equipment and expertise from Brazil. Yeah. But the industry was heavily dependent on slave labor. So Lincoln ran into the religious logic used to justify slavery when a black slave, to whom he had explained the workings of a compass, asked if he could convert to Christianity. For he thought to be a Christian was to be endued with all those knowledges he wanted. Lincoln relayed this request to the slave's master and was told that slaves were not allowed to convert, since by the laws of England, we could not make a Christian a slave. So any slaves who were allowed to convert would have to be freed. And that was unthinkable, since it would have stopped the lucrative sugar business in its tracks. Within a decade, Barbados dominated the sugar trade, making its sugar barons among the richest men in the New World. The planters in Barbados gained more than just sugarcane and equipment from Brazil. They also learned how to ferment the byproducts of the sugar-making process and then to distill the results in a powerful alcoholic drink. Remember, we're talking about the first global drink. The Portuguese called it cane brandy, and they made it from the foam skimmed off the boiling cane juice, or from the cane juice itself. And this process was further refined on Barbados. However, where the cane brand was made from molasses, the otherwise worthless leftovers from sugar making. This made it possible to make cane brandy far more cheaply and without any reduction in the output of sugar. According to Lincoln, the resulting drink, known as Kill Devil, was infinitely strong, but not very pleasant in taste. The people drink much of it, indeed too much, for it often lays them asleep on the ground. Rum became popular among sailors and from 1655 was adopted as a substitute to the traditional ration of beer on the Royal Navy ships in the Caribbean. Within a century, it became the Navy's preferred drink during long cruises. Replacing the usual gallon of perishable wheat beer for a half pint of rum had predictable consequences for discipline and efficiency, however, and prompted Admiral Edward Vernon to issue an order that the rum should be mixed with 2 pints of water. Diluting the rum had no effect on the total amount of alcohol consumed, though it made the sailors more inclined to drink the otherwise unpalatable water available on board ships. What turned out to be far more important was Vernon's idea to add sugar and lime juice to the mixture to make it more palatable. He had invented a primitive cocktail that was immediately named in his honor. Vernon's nickname was Old Grogram because he wore a waterproof cloak made of gorgrum, a coarse fabric stiffened with gum. His new drink became known as grog. That's where it came from. The problem remained that the strength of rum varied widely, and sailors who saw this rum being watered down to make grog felt shortchanged. Hey, what the hell? Before the invention of an accurate hydrometer in the 19th century, there was no easy way to measure the strength of an alcoholic drink. So the Navy's pursers, who were responsible for distributing the rum ration, measured the strength of the unmixed rum beforehand using a rule of thumb said to be devised by the Royal Arsenal. They mixed the rum with a little water and a few grains of black gunpowder, then heated the mixture using a magnifying glass to concentrate the rays of the sun. If the gunpowder failed to ignite, the mixture was too weak and more rum would be added. Only when the gunpowder just barely ignited was the mixture deemed to be the correct strength, which corresponds to 48% alcohol. If the mixture was too strong, an explosion would ensue. And tradition has it that sailors who were then entitled to help themselves while the purser was incapacitated. So if the purser blew himself, can you imagine?
For a while,
It's hard to be a Mason and not be happy. It's hard to just enjoy the benefits of what we have around. Every disappointment that you and I face gives us an opportunity to just absolutely enjoy the hunt, the chase for the things that we crave. So excuse me if that hunt, the journey, the adventure goes on one more day. Excuse me. What? Life too much for you to handle? Have to have it all laid out in front of you? When you see people competing for the experience, you know those kind of have to do more things. Not do more things, but tell everybody what they're doing. Just give them a smile and a nod. They're pursuing something that it's like it's like sitting down to a whole meal that really isn't very fulfilling. They'll always have that hunger. You, on the other hand, come and sit back. We'll sample from a meal of tasty, rich foods, but only little tastes at a time. Everything in a bit of moderation. And maybe if you have one glass too much, we'll sit there together and smile, share a laugh. Let's give you a little note from another keynote speaker at the annual communications, a fellow Christopher Hodak. You might have heard of him. He's an author as well. He wrote Freemasons for the noble name, Freemasons for Dummies. But he writes, apart from that, sort of the glibness of it all, he has some interesting things to say. He says young men are starting to rediscover Freemasonry. This new generation of Masons wants to associate with something ancient, something mythical, and something legendary. A group that has been the fraternity of the greatest of men for three centuries. A fraternity that is worldwide in its scope and universal in its welcoming of all faiths and all races. A local lodge that helps the family next door and the school down the street. A group that once was at the forefront of issues that shaped this country and arguably was the crucible that gave birth to the revolution. A little bit of America. Get your guns out, boys. Because they were men of action and social conscience. So were the early Canadians there, Sonny? Men of action? Just throw your kit into a canoe, head up a beautiful, beautiful stream. You didn't even have a copy of Thoreau's Walden Pond in your pocket, but away you went. Didn't starve. Adventurous? Courageous? Oh, yeah. A fraternity that claims as its members the most imaginative minds and the most successful of men. We look around our lodges and we may not see that greatness, but remember, we accumulated. That greatness wasn't pouring out the doors of every lodge. There was one genius sometime, and another genius sometime, and another man. It wasn't like these men were doing things, saying and thinking, unless they're really daft, this is going to be monumental, history will remember me. That's too egocentric, yeah. These were men that did what they thought was right for the reasons they thought were valuable. History was kind to them. So when you look around the room, you never know whether this person sitting next to you is going to be the next fellow that history treats kindly, or the fellow that he influences in the next generation. Maybe it's him. Those degrees of separation become very small. So what Hodapp's talking about is expectations. Expectations far beyond the capability of any lodge or any one person to provide, but we need to be able to put them in context to help the young fellow pull in his energies, to be able to channel it into something very productive. So I have to go. It's been absolutely wonderful. I'll look forward to hearing from you and your advice as usual, as you're committing acts of Masonic kindness everywhere that you go. Remember, it's 5 o'clock somewhere. Jimmy Buffett reminded us all of that and doesn't seem to be too embarrassed about us getting a little older. And for those who think that that all things Masonic are the way that we need to live and breathe, take a look outside the doors of the lodge. There's a lot of really, really interesting ideas going on. I'm going to leave you a little foot stomping part of Canada and North America, and I'll look forward to seeing you all soon. And if you're at the annual communication next week, let's shake hands and have a talk. That's it, boys. See you again soon. Thanks for joining.